Look, the Chicago way is a deep cultural phenomenon.
It's the Chicago way.
The Chicago way. That's the focus.
In a tower by the river, there lived a man. There was a man who took a stand. With pen and paper in his hand. Defeating foes in every ward with a pen more mighty than the sword. No escape from his ink lasso. In a tower by the river, Castle.
Here's how you get him. He pulls a knife, you pull a gun. He sends one of yours to the hospital, you send one of his to the morgue. That's the Chicago way.
It's a very confusing time, everybody. You know that. Welcome to the Chicago way. We've got Charles Lipson as our guest. Charles Lipson, professor emeritus, University of Chicago, author of many great pieces recently, too, that I think are most impressive and most important. Cleaning House at the FBI and the Justice Department is one. And the other one, most recent, is Biden robs Peter to get Paul's vote. I wonder where that quote comes from, because I've been trying to find out if did Voltaire actually say that, did he give that quote that is misattributed to him about the government and the people being bribed with their own money? And it turns out that's not true. But with all this stuff going on, I thought and the President Biden, who just, what wasn't it 2 years ago or so, his inauguration, telling us that his heart was in the right place and he was going to treat his opponents with respect. And now he's out, just as we sit down tonight, he's out in Maryland and Steny Hoyer's land, saying that if you're a Republican, if you voted for Trump, so that's 75 million people, you're nothing but a fascist. You are a fascist. And this is where we're going. So Charles Lipson inspired me to write my own column, reading his stuff. I write my own column about burying those FBI tomahawks. Where do we bury them, Charles Lipson?
Well, you know, Biden said that Trump supporters were semi-fascists, I assume meant that they drove 18-wheelers.
Right, I'd be semi-fascist.
And therefore did not qualify for any of the student loan rebates.
Is that like semi-sweet chocolate? Is that like semi-fascist? It's like kind of not that
I think
good,
it's like softcore porn.
Using it in baking. Oh, yeah.
The public back and forth of our politics is so low. Nah. And I don't particularly attribute that to Biden. A lot of Trump's arguments were essentially ad hominem attacks on people. Yeah. So it's not as if one person started it. But what we have now is a very divided nation. We have a technology that allows us to watch the news or read it or whatever, only the kind of news that confirms our existing biases. Mm-hmm. And then we have a lot of devices, Twitter is the main one, that are sort of short attention span. So you say something outrageous, and we have all these backbenchers in Congress. Good example would be somebody like Matt Gaetz, who are not really influential legislators, but they used to appear, at least before he was accused of various illegal acts and so forth, used to appear a lot on right-wing cable shows. Right. And then there's the equivalent on the left. And I just think it's a sort of degradation of the public sphere. And it's been, you can see how that's working in primaries, in our primary elections, because we have sort of ascendant sections of both parties which are able to win primaries and prevent more centrist candidates from expressing those views, and then go into the general election where there's a large middle swath of voters who sort of have nobody to pick from.
Well, there are many Democrats out today now who are basically condemning the president or criticizing the president for his giveaway of between $300 billion and $900 billion, mm-hmm. Where basically the elites get help and your average working class person who didn't go to college has to pay for it.
That's exactly right. The column that I wrote about it, which appeared in The Spectator, which is an English publication that now has a large American presence,
yes,
and website, I said that there were several problems with it and that I thought that that there would be more political blowback than political gain for the president. And I wrote that as soon as he made the decision, and it looks like over the next day that's exactly what's happened. Let me say two or three of the problems. The first one, obviously, is inflation. There's no taxes that are going to pay for this, so how are you going to pay for it? You're going to print money.
Yeah.
And the second one, which is one that you highlighted, is what economists call income regression effects or regressive income effects, which means you're giving money to higher income people at the expense of lower income people. But that's partly true, but it's not quite right, because really a lot of the people who are receiving the money are younger people who are on their way up. So their income right now might be below $125,000, which doesn't sound very low to me, frankly. I mean, it sounds
right.
Pretty good money. And I mean, it's twice the average teacher's salary, mm-hmm. not in Chicago, but nationwide. And but they're rising. You can get this rebate if you've got graduate degrees and all the rest. Mm. So these are people who, whatever their income is now, they're on their way up, and that's why they borrowed the money to go to school. The third thing, which I think will actually blow the program out of the water,
is that it's illegal.
It's more than illegal. It's unconstitutional. And it's important to understand why that is. This is the largest single expenditure by presidential fiat in the history of our country. And I think that would be true in real dollar terms. I mean, if you went back and looked at any expenditure and put them into 2022 dollars, the Secretary of Education today was asked how much it would cost, and he can't even say.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, this is like the Keystone Cops. But estimates are between $300 and $900 billion by one presidential signature. But our Constitution requires that expenditures be made
by the Congress,
by congressional authorization. Right. So under what authorization is he doing this? Well, he says he's doing it under an act which basically allowed us to make payments to people who were first responders for 9/11. Said that if there was a national emergency, you could do something. So he's saying there's a COVID national emergency, but his own Justice Department went before federal courts and abolished some of the Section 42, where people could be sent back to their home countries if they were illegal immigrants, because they said there's no COVID emergency.
Well,
he's got a thing tonight where everybody's meeting.
They're not wearing masks. They're not wearing masks in Steny Hoyer land.
Right. It's utterly inconsistent. But the key point about constitutionality is that the very core of our government is that sovereign power is really, we call it separated, but in effect it's shared among three branches, the legislative, executive, and judicial. And the idea behind that was that no one of those branches would be able to become tyrannical. The founding fathers originally thought it would be Congress that became tyrannical, but there are dangers, you know, with every branch, and especially these days with the executive branch. But I think that Biden will not be able to get this through. And the fact that what you said, John, that people like Ryan, who is running for Senate in Ohio, is renouncing this, and you have people in other states with a lot of blue collar workers, they're just saying this is nuts.
The voice you might hear besides Charles Lipson, who, you know, Charles, you have a just a killer voice. I'm just saying that.
Why? And thank you, John.
I'm kind of like smitten by the voice. And I just imagine it in the lecture halls of, at the University of Chicago. And but the other voice who's like, and the green is the guy I forgot to introduce. What's your name again, sir? Jeff Carlin.
Oh, hey, thanks, John. Hey, Charles.
WGN Radio.
Hey, Jeff. I've got a recording of you around the house where I can just push a button after I say things, and it says, yes, that's right.
I love it. Well, I mean, Charles, I'm always like John, I could listen to you wax about politics forever. It is one of my favorite pastimes. You're talking about the idea of this whole loan program, and I'm somebody who's going to benefit from this because I have about $10,000 in Pell grants, that I used to go to school, because I was raised taught that the only way to advance was through a college degree, and that was the most important thing, and this is what you must do. And so I signed my name and said, "Hey, give me some money, I'll do what I can." And I've been paying, and you know, it sucks, but you keep paying, and this will be a windfall for me. The idea that it'd be the unconstitutional.
I had urged John to actually give you more than they give the fry guys at McDonald's, but apparently not.
You know, Jeff is growing every day in his endeavors, and we're not going to just have him be a robot like at McDonald's.
Yeah, right.
But no, that's really interesting. It's going to help you directly.
Yes. Jeff.
Well, right, and I mean, but and the savings is, you know, going to be a couple $100 a month for me that I'm not paying to the government. Ultimately, then, instead of actually getting that money, you know, in a lump sum, which kind of leads me to the idea that may be the constitutional loopholes that the president is essentially nullifying funds that were already discretionarily set aside for these grant programs. And the interest on those payments is really where the government's going to lose out on top of it, which is
as if by design.
Well, right. Okay. By design.
Right.
And the real argument is that the president's kind of doing the same thing that they did with the COVID, you know, PPP program, except it was that was directed and written by Congress. You know, it was right. No fraud.
But the Congress approved it.
Right. Well, that's the thing. That's the difference.
Congress approved it, and they approved it because they were trying to rescue small businesses that were going to be put out of business because the government itself had required the economy to shut down. So I do understand that. There was a lot of fraud.
Absolutely.
In the PPP program. That's a different matter, and they should go after that.
And they are. You see stories all the time. I mean, in Chicago, luckily we've got a branch here, federal investigators, but they've just announced, you know, so-and-so is running a shoe shop, and they happen to have seven shoe shops in the same apartment.
Lori Lightfoot senior cops got?
Well, they don't have to spend much time actually chasing people because they prohibited that now.
Charles, you're on the verge of being accused, like our good friend Dan Proft, who will be on at another podcast with us. If you criticize her, you're apt to be condemned as a dog whistling racist. You cannot mention the fact that she is not handling crime.
Well, first of all, my dog is literally at my feet right now, And he does not consider the term dog whistling to be a negative term in any way. He considers that the highest praise.
Well, everything's relative.
You know how smart dogs are, that they can, a dog whistle can be directed at a Democrat, but it can be interpreted by a Republican dog. A Republican dog can, a conservative dog can interpret, you know, various political dog whistles at the same time.
It's interesting. I'm glad you mentioned this thing about dog whistles. Mm-hmm. Because I actually participated in an experiment. Another student, she's now a professor at the University of Texas at Austin. She was not my student. She was studying American politics. But she had me record three advertisements. And the first one was a kind of straight advertisement. And then the second one had a little bit of a dog whistle. And the third had more of a dog whistle in her terms. And so she was doing experiments with people to see how they responded to those. And I do think that there are subtle signals that people send. I mean, all the time. But I'm more concerned, actually, about this requirement that is now spreading among universities and maybe others, where you have to make ideological declarations to even be considered for employment.
And that's is that going to increase diversity on campus or limit diversity?
Well, here's the point. First of all,
are you going to tell me that diversity is only about is not about the thought? It's not about cut of mind.
That's
because
exactly
if you do what, that, you're, that's a dog whistle, and you're making me think that they're racist about. Because how dare you?
Well, what's happening now? If you go back 30, 40 years and you look at the distribution of political affiliation in top universities, they were more Democratic than Republican, but there was a kind of mix. Now the numbers are just astronomical. Yeah. More than 20, 30, 40 to one. And it's worse than that. I mean, even starting 10 or 15 years ago, I had students from other departments come to me and say, I actually have views that are kind of out of step with the other people in my department, and they were more conservative views,
right.
Were no sense racist. They were no sense, they were perfectly acceptable kind of views that you would want to see debated and encouraged. And they said, what should I do? And the only analogy I could think of was what a gay professor in 1952 would have felt like if a gay student from another department came and said, I can't reveal who I am to anybody in the university because I won't be hired. I'll be excluded. People won't talk to me. You know, I mean, it'll be
especially
a problem.
If that gay student were homosexual.
Exactly.
And then say, you can say, well, you could take refuge in the fact that you're homosexual, but don't tell anybody that you might be a communist, because then you're really screwed.
Well, I mean, all of these things were, there was a very famous moment. Mm-hmm. The University of Chicago considers it one of its high points, really, during the 1930s, when Charles Walgreen, person who founded the chain, came to the president of the university and said, I understand that they're communists on your faculty, and I want to see them fired. And the president of the university, Robert Maynard Hutchins, told him to get lost, and he could take his money with him. But I mean the sense that, so there are two issues there. One is who gets to make decisions. The universities do, but there's also a sense, and I certainly had it when I first entered the political science department at the University of Chicago. I had just come from Harvard, and I would say at Harvard, everybody had what I would call the New Yorker view of the world, right? I mean, a very narrow political spectrum. Mm-hmm. And when I got to Chicago, there were people who are renowned conservatives and people who were actually communists. I mean, it was a wide spectrum. And you could hear really interesting debates. One of the most interesting when I started, John and Jeff, was about American exceptionalism. Was America an exceptional nation? And it was a debate that we used to have at lunch and so forth, right, where people who studied France or people who studied Japan or America or international politics, everybody could weigh in. And it was an interesting sort of debate that drew us all together and was about a serious issue. And that's what university should be.
Yeah. It's, I mean, it's crazy because you feel like you learn more ultimately from exploring, you know, the idea of, you know, thought and what, you know, policy and even in, you know, recent history. And I think you learn more about your own beliefs and understanding of how you feel by hearing from other people's, you know, ideas. And it's this weirdness, like you hit on earlier, where all of our news media or anything anybody you know, intakes anymore comes from some place where it's specifically driven to fit their need. We're making everything much more tailored to us individually, almost creating our own like hyper reality. Yeah, but it's almost like a hyper reality. You know, that's
exactly right. Amplified. And you could see us slipping down a very slippery slope. Dorms, mm-hmm, now in Berkeley, California, that don't allow whites, in Minneapolis. The teachers union and the city school board are agreeing to fire white teachers first. That may or seems unlikely to be able to get past a court review. But the fact that people who think of themselves, I'm sure, as being very much committed to social justice, think that you can typecast everybody by the race they're born into and cannot change is, to me, deeply antithetical to the best American values.
There was a time when a leftist, a conservative, and a conservative could have shish kebab at that Armenian restaurant down the street from the Tribune. Remember that place that all the WFMT guys would go with Syed Nova?
Yes,
University of Chicago guys.
WFMT guys.
Right. Yeah. That's
yeah. I had many a meal there with Arson, the late great Milt Rosenberg.
That's right.
Not bad.
I'm going to be with his son in the North Shore.
Matt
and I take they're billing it as the Chicago Way goes to the North Shore. We're going to be talking to the new tour neighbors. So I guess if you're interested in showing up, now you don't have to show up, Charles. We can have a burger anywhere. But but anyone who wants to go, find it on social media and hope you go.
Oh, that sounds fun.
I need to ask you this. I've got to ask you a serious question to both of you. When, and I think it's the magic of the internet, mm-hmm, that now when you hear of a quote, so I see Biden passing out these insane amounts to the elite to take care of his politics for college tuition, and thinking about those who didn't go to college and just maybe bought a F-150 truck and and some tools so they could work in their own field or whatever field they thought of, and I thought of the aldermen of the days in the 1950s passing out turkeys and hams on election on election that day. You know, here's your turkey, here's your ham, committeeman so and so. So the point is, there was a quote attributed to de Tocqueville, the Frenchman: "The American Republic will endure until the day Congress discovers that it can bribe the people with the people's money." Unfortunately, it's a great quote. Unfortunately, he never said it. But there are other quotes attributed to other people around that on that idea. Alexander Brazier Tyler, and a fellow named Elmer Peterson from the Daily Oklahoma, who said this, and I want your reaction to it.
Mm-hmm.
A democracy cannot exist as a permanent form of government. It can only exist until the majority discovers it can vote itself largesse out of the public treasury. After that, the majority always votes for the candidate promising the most benefits, with the result of the democracy collapsing because of the loose fiscal policy, always to be followed by dictatorship and then a monarchy.
Well, and you can forget about monarchy, but yeah. I would say that the progressives think that that's exactly what Republicans do for the rich. And conservatives, I mean, they think that if you think about Reagan's tax bill, which was a very fair tax bill, basically he took very high rates. He didn't just reduce rates. He reduced them to two brackets and with a cutoff down below where you didn't have to pay anything. Right. Remember there was a day 50 years ago where doctors used to own herds of cattle out in Wyoming and so forth, not because they wanted to raise cattle, but because they wanted to transfer their income from regular income into capital gains and that sort of thing. So you get deadweight economic losses. But what Reagan did was he sharpened and flattened the income tax system, so it was down to two rates. And then what happens, it's like a boat whose hull has been cleaned. And then what happens over years and years and years is barnacles build up. And those barnacles are special interests putting in a loophole here, a special expenditure there. Mm-hmm. So that's all true. I just would warn you against thinking it's only one group that wants it. Everybody bellies up to the trough. And you and I can remember, John, but you cannot, Jeff. There was a day when somebody who was a congressman or a senator finished his or her term and then came back to his home district and in retirement. But now there's so much money in Washington, they all stay there.
And their wives or husbands have to stay there as lobbyists.
Right.
Like Senator Durbin.
Well, or they can stay in Napa and have a drink.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, check out Peter Schweizer's book, Throw Them All Out. It's a great breakdown of how people in Congress always end up becoming quite wealthy when they leave Congress. And why do we think that
Mitch McConnell? Okay, but listen, I'm just...
Well, Mitch McConnell's got a very wealthy wife.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I think she's involved in China shipping. Oh, I don't know.
Well, that's right. That's what her family does.
Right.
But
I wasn't referring to any particular side. I didn't.
Right. I know
wasn't
you were.
Saying, well, I wasn't saying liberals do this or leftists and rightists or whatever. The people, the appetites of the people, once it's leveraged in terms of money that from the, like this deal, like this ridiculous, loan bailout.
Exactly.
This stuff accelerates to the point where eventually there's economic catastrophe. And when economic catastrophe, there's authoritarian, impulse. And my concern is that we're on that path.
Well, you raised a second issue early on about what we would talk about, and that was the raid on Mar-a-Lago. Mm. And that is one where a number of people have been very concerned about that raid. And I have friends on both sides. Actually, there's more than two sides in this.
Yes.
There are people who are pro-Trump conservatives, there are people who are anti-Trump conservatives, and then there are a variety of liberals. And I think that the issue there that is whether they could have taken measures with a lighter hand. They did something that's been unprecedented in the history of the country, which is raid the home of a former president. And then what you hear is a series of self-justifying leaks from the Justice Department, which should never occur.
That's what the Kamalists do. That's how they play.
Exactly. Exactly. And they say, well, there were very top secret documents. And then you have, then you have people on MSNBC saying, well, you should just behead Trump. You know, I mean, he should be executed as a traitor.
Yes.
I mean, it's as if the sounds word like prudence has never entered anybody's mind.
Yeah, I mean, we talked about it with Tom last week.
Bevin? Yeah.
Bevin. I mean, it was that whole idea that it's regardless of justification or whatever the legal parameters of that are doing this, the look was just, it's bad for so many reasons, not just, I mean, domestically, but internationally. It weakens us as a, you know, as these, this is, we were talking about a little earlier, is this, you know, exceptional nation. We're attacking our own. And I think to Charles, your piece, you kind of got to the idea of what do we do now with it? You know, if nobody has, not nobody, but if the general trust in this entity of the FBI is so diminished and tarnished, what do we do next?
Well, it's a big problem because there's both high level incompetence combined with bureaucratic self-protection.
Right.
And
spell that,
that's
Peter
on the
Strzok,
one hand.
Right?
And then the second big pot is a pretty strong perception of political bias at the highest levels.
Just a small one or a big one?
Oh, man.
Yeah,
big.
It's clear.
And we've learned today that the FBI, they're according to the Senator reports, Ron Johnson of Wisconsin, there have been FBI agents, whistleblowers, who've come to, not dog whistleblowers, but just whistleblowers, who've come to him and said that the FBI agents were explicitly told to hold off on any investigation of Hunter Biden's laptop because of the election. But the FBI agents then went even further than killing the story. They put out the story from the FBI, and of course the CIA's former officials put it out, so it would seem as if to the average viewer that these people actually knew something, that this was all Russian disinformation. Well, it was disinformation, all right. It was their disinformation.
Zuckerberg came out publicly and said on the Joe Rogan podcast that the FBI came to Facebook and said, don't run this Hunter Biden stuff because it's Russian disinformation. That to me is, I don't know, is that a felony? I mean, can the FBI influence elections that way?
Well, they can. And look, nothing ever seems to happen to these guys, right? We know there was fraud before the FISA courts, getting secret warrants. We had a guy from the North Shore who is now Attorney General, senior,
right?
Come out and say this was a narrowly drawn search. But you look at the search warrants, which have now been made public, it was not narrowly drawn at all.
Everything that Trump, any paper that Trump generated in the 4 years he was president.
Basically, they could seize it. And so that looked to me, not that the courts would ever find it, but there's something called a general warrant. And those are prohibited by the Constitution. Right. And the reason that they're prohibited is that the British used them to go after a person. So you find, show me the person and I'll show you the crime. And that's the problem with a general warrant. And So I think that there are some serious problems at the FBI, and it's very clear that Christopher Wray has not been able to clean them up, or maybe didn't want to. And it's very clear that Bill Barr took Christopher Wray's word when Barr said, we really do need to do some serious house cleaning there. And he took Wray's word that Wray would do it, and Wray never did. And of course, the current DOJ has no interest in doing that at all.
Yeah.
We're in a bad place constitutionally, politically. And but still, I got off the phone with some friends from the FBI that I was supportive, as Jeff knows, of the FBI when they were doing corruption fighting here in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken to their group, to the group's graduations.
Under oath,
and
John?
So, yeah, under oath. And I'm sure I'm going to be accused of some crime from my former Jacobin Nape editors. Like, how dare you advise or discuss anything with Lori Lightfoot back when we were friends? Because people do this stuff when they're in human beings. But the FBI guys that I know are seeing this thing unfold, and they're very upset.
They
feel themselves, the rank and file pros, and they feel themselves under siege, kind of like cops do under siege. And I said, okay, to one of them, I said, okay, I'll give you 900 words. Write out what you're feeling and how, as long as you're not libeling somebody, and we'll check it all, let's hear what you have to say on the subject. Write it out. Give me a column. To johncastnews.com. And I hope he does it.
Yeah, I mean,
well, you're reminding me of something, which is I'm a former university professor, now emeritus, which I remind all listeners means great with merit. You work for a newspaper, and John, and these are our institutions that are in deep, deep trouble.
Yep.
And so we look back on the institutions that we joined when we were younger and spent our professional lives in, and we look back with a lot of sadness. And I don't know if that's true for you, Jeff. I mean, you've been in broadcasting, but in a way there's a flourishing new kind of radio, which is podcasting,
what we're doing now.
Yeah. Follow the message. Yeah.
But Jeff, do you feel clearly the industry's changed, but I don't think it's changed as fundamentally off course as is American journalism and the universities, which are basically, the marching ground of the left. I don't think broadcast.
But broadcast has pretty rigid guide rails for what you can do, can and can't do. The FCC is very stringent, and the fines are very hefty if you do things that either is stealing people's licenses or things like that nature. It also includes content. I mean, people can complain to the FCC that you're being they call breaking the public trust with whatever you're broadcasting. So that's kind of why
many ideas.
Yeah, right. That's why radio kind of has and TV to an extent too. Not cable, but broadcast TV has that. It's slower to change. We have around elections, you have to carry people's messages on from both sides. If a candidate is legitimate, you have to put them on. I mean, there are a lot of rules in place that kind of keep.
That's a good point. But it's also it's a marketplace that has really changed quite dramatically. Mm-hmm. When FM came in, you had better sound quality, so all the music moved over to FM, or most of it did. AM became talk. You had some conservative, some left. I mean, and then you've had a lot of consolidation at the national level. Then you've had these new services, Spotify and the like, come in.
Right.
Satellite services. And now I think all this great podcasting. I love podcasting. because you can do long form things. The other day, I was interviewed on some television channel or something, and they were the person said to me before we went on, he said, "Well, we can really get into depth on this. You know, I have 8 minutes, you know," and I just thought, right. Well, you know, we, that's the kind of world that we live in, that, it sort of pays for a short, attention span. And that's, mm-hmm. that's regrettable. You were talking about Lori Lightfoot and these accusations of racism. And I grew up in the South, at the tail end of Jim Crow South. And for anybody who had that kind of experience, you can only look at the changes over the last, say, 60 years as being enormously positive. Not uniformly so. I don't mean all the outcomes have been positive, but just the amount of the lessening of discrimination, the fact that, you know, it was
around the time time Richard Daley is screaming at Abraham Ribicoff, mm-hmm. "Go fly a kite," or whatever he was saying. Remember, right. You faker,
right.
Faker.
Right.
Right. At that time, if I had told you, mm-hmm. The mayor would be, we'd have a black mayor
after a Jewish mayor.
After a Jewish mayor.
Right,
we'd have a, black chief judge. We'd have a black Cook County board president. And we'd have a black state's attorney. Nobody would believe it.
No.
I don't know what she's... And what is she... Her
science fiction.
Effectively, and I don't want
to... But if you said all of that, and you said... And yet, the South Side and the West Side would be so dangerous that... what people used to do in the 40s when it was hot, sleep out on their back porches and that sort of thing. Nobody would even begin to think of that these days. They would find that extremely disheartening, and rightly so.
Good point.
The point of what she's doing, and we'll get into that in the next, during the next podcast, but I should ask you, Charles and Jeff, what she's doing is similar to the people that accused me of being anti-Semitic because I dared question George Soros's payments of political money to Kim Fox. And but this time they're going after Dan Proft, saying he's darkened her skin, and these are dog whistles, and how dare you question her. And the issue is that black people are and brown people are being slaughtered in the streets of Chicago every day. And last time I checked, she was talking in terms of being favorably disposed to people of color. But I guess now that they're being slaughtered, where's she now?
Well, we had, first of all, mobilizing constituency is along racial, ethnic, religious lines, is as old as old as the trees, and but it's there's something sort of different about it today because it has an edge that we're not only mobilizing you because you're a fine Italian American or whatever, but it implies that the other groups are somehow bad, evil, and out to get you. And I think that turns out to be very divisive and predictably so. And when you have sort of blatantly, to me, unconstitutional moves where you're going to fire one group on the basis of race, or where you're going to say housing in some public accommodation is only on the basis of race. I just
promotions.
Think we've gone back to the worst days of racial segregation.
That's why equity to me, thoroughly means equity means racism, government sanctioned racism, because political people use that term. And she's using the term Lightfoot, and Preckwinkle uses it, Fox uses it, and so does Pritzker, the white pasty faced guy, you know. And
these are terms that have no clear meaning. Diversity, equity, and inclusion. Right. They sound good, and right. It would be nice to know what they meant. But these are kind of like Alice in Wonderland words. They mean whatever I want them to mean. And
do they mean eat me like the cake? Sorry, I've had a few drinks. I shouldn't podcast with a few drinks.
Oh, that's all good.
Oh my! I can see the high quality that you want to maintain, the high tone that you want to maintain on this podcast, John.
18-year-old.
Don't
Scott.
You have any control over this man?
Oh no, John is a cast.
Why did you let me? Why did you let me have that Glenmorangie? 18 years old.
Hey, Charles, while we got you, I wanted to ask you, you kind of talked to it earlier about the idea of the primaries where we're seeing more and more, you know, fringe or further away from the mm-hmm. center or just even reality. Candidates kind of, you know, drumming up sensationalism, for lack of a better word, in their candidacy platforms. How do you feel with what they are doing in Alaska with like the ranked choice voting? I mean, to me, it feels very democratic. It does feel, you know, very representative of beliefs and, you know, and what's best for my interests. But I know that there is some criticism of it.
I am glad you asked that question, because I have actually not only participated in a ranked choice voting, I have actually been one of the people who counted the votes. That's how we elect people to various university-wide committees at the University of Chicago. And I kind of like it. Let me explain. We called it the H-A-R-E, Hare system, because a man named Hare invented it. But ranked choice is a better way. So let's say that all three of us, John, Jeff, and Charles, are running for office. And
can I be the communist?
Sure.
Okay.
And so anybody who comes in to vote can put down number one for Jeff and number two for John, and doesn't have to put down number three for Charles. Right. He can vote or not vote for Charles. Okay. Or for any of us, he can, in some of these university things, there were seven positions that were open on the council. There were 20 names. You could write as many numbers as you wanted, up to 20. Okay. Mm-hmm. And the way it goes is that you look, you count and see who gets the lowest number of votes first. So Charles gets the lowest number of votes. Okay, now what we do is we take all the people, lowest number of number one
first votes.
So now we take all of Charles's votes and we distribute them between Jeff and John according to whether that voter voted as his second choice, Jeff or John.
Uh-huh.
Or nobody. If he voted nobody, the ballot is now discarded.
Right.
He didn't have a choice between the two of you. Some people complain about that, but it seems to me if that person didn't have any choice between the two of you, why should that matter? Okay. Right. But let's say three of the voters thought that Jeff was the best second choice, and two of the voters thought John was the best second choice. Well, that's what happens next. So Jeff gets those three votes. John gets those two. Now we count and see who has the least number one votes. And then the other guy wins. Right? I mean, you know, so that's the way we do it. And the advantage that seems to me to have is you think about
you get these, the sense of the electorate. You
exactly. The, well, think about an Academy Awards thing for the best picture. And if you have two pictures that are kind of alike, they're romantic comedies, or they come from the same studio, or whatever it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Those will cancel each other out because they'll split the vote, and some other movie will come in first. Where if you had ranked voting, less popular of the two romantic comedies, its votes would be thrown out. And if the people who like romantic comedies made their second choice the other one, then it would get more votes. And so you would get different outcomes.
Didn't we have a similar system, somewhat like this, in Chicago and Illinois for our legislature before Pat Quinn put his grimy hands all over it? And
well, you mean the 3 and 2 where you had three represent? Yeah, we had something like that. But it's kind of, in a way, it's kind of close to a runoff system.
Or open primary type.
An open primary. But even in an open primary, you know how Chicago Machine used to do the open primaries? They would, you know, if they had their favorite candidate, let's say that person was Irish American, but there were a lot of Italian Americans in the district, they would put two Italian Americans on the ballot to split their vote. But if you had ranked choice voting, that wouldn't work, right? Because I'm just assuming that they vote, their second choice would have been the other Italian American. And so that person would have collected those votes. It will yield something different, but let's go back to what's really happening in these.
What's happening is that Murkowski in Alaska, was basically a liberal, is being protected by the system. Jeff Carlin, my buddy.
Protected by your opinion. Not that that's not my opinion, but.
No, yeah. I didn't. I'm just applying.
It will help her, but that doesn't mean that it's wrong. That the outcome is wrong. But what I do think is the case is that you've got what's disturbing to me about these Republican primaries is that it really, really, really helps to get Donald Trump's endorsement, not in every state, but in most states. And to get his endorsement, you have to say that the 2020 election was stolen. Well, this is deeply corrosive dangerous. Of a stable democracy. Yeah. And there's no evidence for it. I mean, it would be corrosive, even more corrosive, if there was evidence for it. But, I mean, we've had years of court litigation over this. And I understand, I have friends who still say that. And they're not unintelligent people. They have graduate degrees that are well worthy of waiving the loans for. But, but the fact is no neutral body, no neutral court has found that there's evidence. And to have people running for the highest offices in states like Pennsylvania and so forth, who have to make this claim that the 2020 election was stolen, just seems to me ludicrous. And I would like to I hope it is the case that we can get past that kind of crazed politics.
I think that we'll never litigate this to the extent that it should be litigated, but I think that there comes a time when you tell Stacey Abrams or Donald Trump that, no, you didn't win. You're not the governor, Stacey. Right. Hillary, you're not the president.
Right.
Donald, you didn't
win. But that normally starts with the loser. In other words, it's normally that Stacey Abrams concedes to Governor Kemp, but she has refused.
Right.
And it's normally the case that Donald Trump concedes to Joe Biden, but he has refused. And that has put us in a perilous position because they've then gone on to convince a lot of their supporters that their case that the election was stolen is a very strong one.
But listen, at the same time you're saying that, and it's true, I grant, but you have people putting their thumb on the scale at the same time this is happening. So you have the media and the FBI, for example, lining up to beat the hell out of Trump. And basically the impression is the people that run this country don't want this guy anywhere near.
That's right, too. There was somebody who wrote about.
Yeah, it just came out. Corey Franklin just sent it to me, and I can't find it.
Well, there were a book called Rigged.
Yeah, was
right. And was,
our friend Molly Hemingway.
Right, and I think what Hemingway's point is is that all these things that put their finger on the scale. We talked earlier about the FBI suppressing evidence and the government working with social media companies to kill information and all the rest, legitimate information, that rigs an election, but it doesn't mean that the voting machines were themselves dishonest or that dead people voted. Those, and we need to have terms that allow us to distinguish between the two. And I would say that I think a lot of the support that Trump has, and I think you can see DeSantis trying to win a lot of this support as well, is that they think that the insiders who really have power do not have the best interest of ordinary people at heart. They are self-serving. And I think that AOC and a lot of people who are on that most progressive wing of the Democratic Party have a lot of the same feeling. So I would distinguish AOC and, say, Bernie Sanders from the Elizabeth Warren types, and certainly from the Hillary Clinton types, who are really essentially insiders. They want to grab the bureaucracy and give it more power because they think ultimately we should be ruled by experts, not by elected officials.
We should be ruled by the best and the brightest?
Oh, we don't deserve that, do we?
Well, you will remember that the term, I remember the term from the book by David Halberstam, and it was used ironically to refer to all the people from Harvard, especially the Kennedy advisors who went on to serve Johnson, who got us into the mess in Vietnam. And so it was saying these are, quote, the best and the brightest. So use air quotes around them. But really, Jeff and John, you are the best and the brightest.
Yeah, now you are, Charles.
Oh. I'm wearing a corsage for you, Jeff.
I'm just smiling and not saying a thing.
Well, I do think, I mean, it's pretty easy to get yourself into a funk about the state of American politics. And I always try to remind myself of a phrase from the great Adam Smith, who said, there's a great deal of ruin in a nation, meaning you can do a lot of bad things, but a strong, stable nation should be able to get through it. My experience from the late 1960s, when things really were turbulent, is how quickly things returned to normal. And I don't have the same confidence now. But I didn't have it then either. And I just don't know if we'll. And I think that what's different now is that it seems, besides the fact that the country is ideologically divided, it seems like our politics not only have a harsher edge, but have a more ideological tone than they've had in my adult lifetime. I think there are big issues. I think Reagan raised big issues. That was the only other time, really. And I think that you can see that the biggest issue of all, I think, is control by ordinary democratic procedures where Congress passes laws and the president signs them, as opposed to being completely ruled by bureaucrats who pass regulations or presidents who put through executive orders. I think there's a second big issue about America's role in the world. We haven't really talked much about that, but there is an isolationist movement that's probably stronger than at any time since Robert Taft was Mr. Republican in the late 1940s.
Point of personal privilege there, Professor.
Yes,
I would I'd much rather use the term non-interventionist.
Well, that's right. There are people who have a much more restrained notion of intervention, but there are, I mean, it's a spectrum, right? I mean, there are people who are, there are people who simply say, of the fight in Ukraine, for example, both on the left and the right, that's not our fight. That's somebody else's fight. And then, and this doesn't involve U.S. soldiers. It does involve U.S. taxpayers' money. But there are other people who say the Ukrainians want to fight. It's about ultimately about liberty, but it's also about where the Western world of freedom stops. And we have three big enemies in the world, Russia, China, and Iran. And we've got problems with all of them. And I think that we haven't talked about this. There's not time to go into it now, but I think that there are deeper debates about that issue than there have been in 70 years in this country.
Well, like as I think the Chinese say, may you live in interesting times. And I think we do with China on the verge of taking Taiwan. A possible U.S.-China war no one's talking about, the big tech manipulation, and our own domestic politics roiling. I think I'm going to have another drink after the show, okay?
John, I'll conclude by saying that I can remember when I did a lot of stuff on the air for Channel 5 NBC in Chicago.
Right.
And I came down to the studio one day, and some of the fine people who were there, you remember Warner Saunders,
sure,
people like that. He was just a wonderful man. And he said, hello, it's so nice to see you. I said, Warner, you ought to know that when you see me in the studio, it's not because good things have happened.
Well, that's why we called on you today, because everything's so confusing. And even though we're a little bit less confused, the winds of confusion are still, the balls of confusion are still rattling in my head, at least.
It's great to talk to both of you.
For Charles Lipson, Professor Emeritus, our good friend, writer, find his stuff at the Spectator World on Real Clear Politics, or just go to charleslipson.com. And for Jeff Carlin, our buddy, and again, Jeff, I apologize for not introducing you right away. I guess no I've never problem. Done this podcast thing before, 350 episodes. And for...
I'm waiting to Glenn Morangi.
Glenn Morangi, yes.
No.
And for me, John Cass, husband, father, I've been told I've stopped saying Greek Orthodox Christian, and I just say Orthodox Christian, but no slight intended to... the Church of My Fathers, even though I guess by mentioning it, I've already opened the wound even further. Thanks for joining us on another edition of the Chicago Way on WGN Plus.